seven children, of which I was the fourth. Four girls and three boys. And of that number, there are three girls living this time.
And you're the boys?
I'm the boys. One boy died in infancy, and my brothers died at the ages of 71 and 59. My brother Francis was the oldest. Larry was just below me in age. He died at 59.
What kind of work did your father do?
By trade, my father was a pipe fitter, and he continued in that line of work all through his days of employment. The American Bridge Company, which I referred to before.
I had wanted to ask you too about the conditions of your father's work.
Well, the work was very stringent. I never knew my father to be off work for a day or vacation or illness or anything else. For 11 years, he worked night turn. There was little regard for the dignity of the individual as such, the lack of safety precautions in his work. And I've already, in a previous interview, told a story about his being out in the railroad yards at the American Bridge at night, fixing a leak in an underground pipe. And during that, fixing that leak, he heard the rumbling of a train. There were no guards, there were no safety lights, there was no safety signals, there was nothing there. By the time he realized the train was bearing down on him, he scrounged down into an 18-inch hole where he had been working, because he said he knew if he made an attempt to escape, he was going to be, have his legs amputated and not killed. He made his peace with God, said, and waited for the worst to happen. The train passed over his body, and it was only after it had done that the crew realized that there was something wrong. They got out to investigate. They found my father there, still in the hole, and the top of his head had been scraped by the tinder box in the engine, and had it been just a fraction of an inch longer, he would have been killed. And they took him to the first aid hut on the grounds, fixed him up, sent him home in the morning. That was one episode that I should never forget. As we were just getting ready to go out to school when he came home. The other thing that I remember about his working conditions was that when he was working on a tank car and the oil spilled out on him, he was just drenched in his clothing, and there was no place to change. No precautions had been made to take care of an incident like this. And he had to walk a distance of about 8 from the yards to our home, which was a distance of about 8 or 10 blocks, just saturated with oil in bitter cold weather. He was not allowed on any form of transportation because it was would have been a hazard to the other people riding the streetcar. As I said, he was very faithful in his work, never been off sick. And yet, as he was time here for pension consideration, attempts were made by the company to have him retire. would do what he could. This was David C. He would do what he could. He would have my, would my father be willing to submit to the company physician's examination? And my father said he certainly would. He had nothing to hide. Well, they couldn't find anything wrong with him, so he just kept on. But he was gradually demoted. They changed his jobs. And in his last years, he was given sort of a janitorial job to do. And I had asked him one time, when I got older and got more interested in these things, how they figured the pension. See, there was no Social Security. There was no Labor Relations Board. There was nothing. No collective bargaining. This was all before the 30s. And the company had a private pension. And I asked him how the pensions were arrived at. And he said, well, the worker got 1% of his wages in the last 10 years of service. My father's last 10 years of service, 1927 to 1937. And those were the years of the Depression. And his pension was just a meager bit. He lived only about 2 months after he received his first pension check. I think that was somewhere in the neighborhood of $35 a month. It was very small. But this certainly seemed to be a very meager thing after 25 years of service. During the Depression years, might say, to give some idea as to how much that pension was. During the Depression days, they worked 4 hours a day at the Dauber, that 25 cents an hour was the wage. And well, my older brother had left school in his sophomore year to help out, you know, with the family. Finances at the time. His contribution at that particular period wasn't, you know, all that great. But there were, at that time, there were 6 children living, and 2 parents subsisting on that wage. Subsequently, my father died in 1937. He didn't live to see all the things that they had striven for over the years of trying to get a just wage and good working conditions.
Had he helped in the efforts of the others?
Well, there wasn't too much that any individual person could do because of the yellow dog contracts, lockouts. We're told if you're not satisfied, there are 10 others waiting for your job. Well, he was kept there the rest of the night. He knew the man. He was known as Doc Barrett. He was not a doctor, but he had evidently had some kind of first aid training. And he took care of my dad there. They knew Doc Barrett belonged to our parish. So that may have been a factor. He was a good man, too. So, but there was little that, you know, that they could do, that any one person could do in this business of trying to better themselves. So he was brought to task by the procrastinating company. Why did he not have a Uber sticker, you know, on the bumper of their car? And his defense was it doesn't belong to me. But even how scrutinizing they were, so that they picked up on a small thing like that, you know, like that was particular. Herbert Hoover was running for president. Why did he do that? So that was what, that was the way he saved himself on that. The way he responded to that. Car did not belong to him.
Did they have any pressure on the car?
I don't have any recollection of that, but he was, because politics was not a thing that was discussed because of, I think, the fear of recriminations. So us kids knew about, you know, these things that could go out and talk about them and probably bring odium and repercussions on that. But, I of course didn't realize this at the time, but in later years, thinking back on it, there was very little discussion of politics. They didn't ask questions, and therefore they didn't have to appearance, they had to refuse their answers.
What about your mother's
work? Well, my mother, she was primarily a housewife. She came from an agricultural family. My grandfather on her side was a farmer. And her father, and as I said, she came to this country as a small child. And I don't know too much about the family, you know, in the very early years. But she was at home. She was the mother. She was a very important part of the family. And she never worked for wages. After I knew her, from the time I knew her, but there were several doctors that asked her as a favor for them to help them in the birth of, you know, their new life, and she gladly did that. And that was the only kind of outside work. We were ashamed, you know, to think that our mother was working, you know, had to go out to work. We didn't understand what this was all about, but, you know, it was kind of, your mother didn't do that in those days, you know, they didn't leave to go out and do that. But an outstanding incident in the politics in 1920, when the amendment for having women have the franchise. I remember she walked in the first parade advocating women's rights. So she didn't live long enough either to see that brought to fruition. She died in 1927, but in 1920 she was out there walking for women's rights.
Can you remember how you felt about it doing that?
Well, I felt pretty good. I was not, I was just about ready to quit the high school, and I was beginning to have a little bit more interest in things, you know, and I knew it was something special that had never been done before, but I didn't know, of course, understand the impact of the whole thing.
What were some of her ordinary things that she did as a housewife?
Well, we were well fed, well clothed, she cooked and sewed for us, kept the house in order, kept the kids from squabbles. She sewed for us and saw that we were in want, of anything that we needed. And she tried to train us into the ways of, you know, being thrifty, taking care of things, how to, you know, take care of the house, so I could read, to keep in touch with the novenas and the special things that were going on in the church, to keep them reminded of what was coming up. So then we had my mother's eldest sister lived with us the last few years of our lives there. She had come to our home to die because it was quiet. The youngsters were, you know, not a major problem. And so my Aunt Mary came to stay with us, live with us until her death in 1930. But there were other situations to which my aunt could have gone, but for some reason or other, she had another sister who was financially better off, and also their household was less numerous, but she was advised to come to our place. So we had a happy kind of family. We had our ups and downs. And my older brother, during my father's nights at work, my older brother, Francis, we looked up to him. He was taking my father's place at that time. So we wouldn't think any more of disregarding him. My father didn't even pass. So we had a kind of respect for each other, one another.
What were some of your mother's church activities?
Well, my mother belonged to the CD of A. That was, as far as I know, well, and she always helped, you know, and they, on Eve of Feast. I recall this, that in the time of, she was worked around the altar society, but it wasn't called an altar society at that time. She belonged to the LCBA. LCBA.
What's that?
Ladies Benevolent, Catholic Benevolent Association. And she brought me into both of those organizations. I was only in them a couple of months when I entered because I wasn't old enough. But she worked around the church, anything that was needed there, the festivals, and strawberry festivals, card parties, anything that they had to fundraise. Or, as you said, she worked around the altar in preparation for the feast. We lived a good distance there from the church in St. Veronica, so we were about 8 squares from it. So then there was usually nothing much doing in the, you know, around the church except the daily mass. She saw to it that we got to the devotions and that we got our religious instruction. So we got to every Wednesday afternoon at 4:15. Our priest, Father John Martin, had all the kids from the public school, and he personally instructed us. And then, of course, it was the same thing we saw that we got to our Sunday Mass and to Sunday school on Sunday afternoon, where lay teachers taught us with regularity. But we saw that we attended to those things.
That LCBA, what kind of thing?
That was an insurance organization of the, she belonged, or we belonged to Branch 1092. That in Ambridge was affiliated with the St. Veronica Parish. And they had socials and activities, but it was mainly an insurance organization.
How about education?
Well, I think if I could tell you the story of my own experience with the education, that might clarify a lot. I'm just too schooling, formal schooling. But they were astute people. Because education was first and foremost in their minds for all of us. And we never had to try to ever to hide anything about our schooling. For example, my father always reminded us mustering every time to report cards. You know, he kept us on our toes there. He saw that we got our education. And they were very much interested in what went on, seeing that we were on time, good school habits, good learning habits. And also, as I said, we all started in the public schools, the Fourth Ward in Cambridge. And I went through the first six grades there, and then the seventh grade. When I was ready for seventh grade, the junior high school syndrome was just coming into existence. And of course, they had a new junior high school there, so the children from all the four wards who were ready for seventh grade went to the junior high school. So we had to walk, you know, all those walks. That was up here, not too far from the church. But nevertheless, we went there. But my parents weren't satisfied with the results of my junior high school studies. They weren't satisfied with me, I put it that way, because I wasn't doing very much with enjoying life. And so unbeknownst to me, they announced to me one day that, I guess it was after one of these report cards, that they were going to enroll me at St. James's as a wicked. So I didn't fuss. I wasn't too anxious to make the change. But I went to St. James's.
How did you get there?
I commuted on the Pennsylvania Railroad. And so I had 2 years there. I finished the seventh and eighth grade there. They paid tuition. It was a nominal tuition. And I know my parents protested that it wasn't enough. Sister Louise was a principal of the school at the time. And when my parents asked about the tuition, she said, oh, there's no tuition. She said, we'd like to have her without tuition. And they said, no, they wouldn't do it that way. So I'm ashamed that almost to say this, 50 cents a month was the tuition that they charged. So they'd take me for nothing, but they settled for 50 cents. So I was there then for the 7th and 8th grade. Sister Louise was my 7th grade teacher, and I moved in to Sister Pierre's 8th grade. And then after I finished my school there, and maybe I changed because I was serious. I began to get serious about learning, and I liked it, and I worked hard. And I had the notion that that I had to make good for some reason or other. I don't know, but I just there was no pressure on me. I never heard anything from my parents. There weren't any threats, never any pressure, but I wanted to do it. And then when I finished the eighth grade, the question arose momentarily where I should go to high school. See, Baden had no high school at all. So the children from Baden went to Rochester, Freedom, or to Cambridge High Schools, and the borough school board, the school district, paid the tuition. Well, my parents were against my returning to Ambridge because I'd be meeting up with the same people I had been with in junior high. So they said, well, we'd like you to go to Swickley High School, probably high. And here again, that was four more years of commuting on a Pennsylvania Railroad. plus the tuition that I had to pay at Swickley, because Swickley was in the same classification as Pittsburgh Public Schools. They had a longer school year, and consequently, then these others, 180 days was the minimum. But I think Swickley had 200, 120, somewhere in there. So the tuition at Swickley was greater than the tuition in these other schools. And the school board honored my father's request, and they said they would pay as much for me at Swickley as they would pay for students at the other schools. But my father had to make up the difference. So he very gladly did that. So he was very much, you see that they were very much in earnest about getting me some education. And then, when I finished the eighth grade, I wanted to come into the community. Well, my father said no. He said, you're going to have some education before you can act. So my sister Marguerite went to Edinburgh State Teachers College, and she finished there. She had been, when she finished the Ambridge High School business curriculum there, she was employed by the Crucible Steel in Midland, and let's say Mexico between that and now, the Crucible Steel down there. But after she got into it, she didn't like that kind of work. So while she had been a senior at Ambridge High School, there was an epidemic of, I don't remember whether it was chickenpox or one of those children's diseases, but there was a lot of absenteeism among the teachers. Whatever this was, they contracted. So the senior girls had been asked to substitute in the classrooms, you know, for the younger kids. Well, Marguerite volunteered for that. They looked at it as a lark, you know, on it as a lark. So she was sent to the first ward, but she just loved that work. So when she came back, or when the epidemic was over and they finished the school year, she went down to Crucible, and she didn't like it. Well, she was offered and accepted a chance to teach St. Veronica's grade school, and she was sold on teaching, and then she went to Edinburgh and got her diploma from there, teacher's certification and so on. So there was a lot of bigotry at the time in Cambridge, because when it came time for her to apply for a teaching position in Cambridge Public Schools, there were several other girls in the same condition, several of the other girls. They had a difficult time with the school board. They didn't want to hire them. So one of the more influential people who went to bat for them was John O'Donnell. And he was the forerunner of Fitzgerald Funeral, a home up here in Ambridge, and he was Tommy Fitzgerald. I don't know whether I ought to tell this or not, but he was Tommy Fitzgerald's father. And so the John O'Donnell, it was that went to the school board and fought for these Catholic girls, and they subsequently were taken in. And Marguerite remained in the system until she retired after 31 years.
What was John O'Donnell's position?
Oh, he was an undertaker. He owned the O'Donnell Funeral Home. But he was very influential man there. He knew his way around, you know, businessman. And he used to pressure on what pressure was, I couldn't say.
That request of your father to the school board, was that unusual for someone to ask that?
As far as I know, I that time that had happened, but we went to the Manassas. I don't know what the amounts were, you know, but I'm sure it was more than 50 cents.
Was this before St. Veronica's?
Yes, St. Veronica's School. It's interesting that you asked that. When I finished high school in 1924, St. Veronica's grade school had opened, and this was in this this time when they wanted me to go there and teach for a year, but I had my mind made up to come here. Then my sister Margaret went, and she had it for 2 years. Then the high school did not open up there until 29, and my brother Larry graduated from there. So that's that situation. Well, when I lived there, our neighbors were mostly the northern Europeans, you know. But in the school, you see, the influx didn't come there until, it was before my time, early 1900. The first ward, now that was that's up towards Fair Oaks there. That's where most of the immigrants who came in to work in the mills had settled, you know. When they started coming from southern and eastern Europe, they clustered up there. So we didn't come too much in contact with them. As I said, my school experience in the fourth ward, we didn't have too many. There were Italians. And I didn't know that there were any other nationalities at that time, but I do remember some families, and we were quite close to, got along well, you know, with the people. But I would say that we lived in sort of an Irish community down there in the fourth ward.
What about
its name? Well, I'll tell you, it was mostly Irish for this reason, that if you even look at the picture of Ambridge now, you'll find a Catholic church in almost every corner. And as these groups came in, in order to preserve their own identities, they had their own churches, their own parishes.
I've looked at Ambridge.
Well, I know some of these, one of the other ones that I remember so very well, I guess it's a Slovak church, Divine Redeemer. And then later on, the Italian church was a good bit later, it came to be a good bit later. But then the St. Peter's and Paul's and St. Mary's were another Byzantine church. Orthodox churches. It just caused a lot of confusion in my mind. What was the difference, you know? And why did they all have to be separate? But there was a lot of national jealousy, I think, you know, in these churches or in these parishes when they were formed, because each parish wanted to hold its own national because the American Bridge Company was the big place, you know, it was the town is called for it, you know, named for the place. And the town grew up around the American Bridge. Well, then later on we had, you know, the smaller industries that some of them have changed hands many times. The National Metal Molding Company, the Spangs. One of the latest to come and go is Levinson. Levinson Steel. Then it's Little Cox and Babcock. It's hard to say. They opened their plant here. That was one of the more recent ones. But a lot of the people from Ambridge worked over at J&L. And right below where we live, now this goes back to my early childhood when we lived in Ambridge. We lived on Ohio Avenue. It was right above the river. It was right where Route 65 is now. It was a regular ferry took the men across the river. We could see that from our front porch, watching. I was very much interested in it myself. As a little kid, I asked the ferryman to take me for a ride. My father nearly had a heart attack when he found out I was out in water.
He actually manned the
ferry. Sure. He passed our place going to his work every day, and I was black. What's his name? I asked him if I could go for a ride. Somebody said, sure, so he took me. And of course, you know, I was in there. Anybody's permission to go, I just went off. But then my father decided, well, since we liked the water so much, he hired Mr. Black to take us on Sundays.
Okay.
Yes, we go to Walnut Beach. But that was quickly. And we didn't go every Sunday, but he took us out. They were so, that's what they like, but he ain't pleased. So, but I do remember the ferry.
What made you want to be a sister?
Oh, that's crazy, yes. Because nobody ever talked to me individually about it. And the only thing that I remember was we were nearing the end of our eighth grade. Sister Pierce said to all of us as a group, "Boy, you're getting near the end now. I think, I hope you're beginning to think of what you want to do." Well, time on, I never wanted to do anything else but just be here, get here.
Who are some of the sisters you knew at school?
Well, Sister Pierre and Sister Louise. Sister Mary Irene was on the faculty there. I don't think she was on while I was a student in school, but when I went to high school, I spent a good deal of time on my lunch hour and after school, maybe waiting to go on the train because they commuted up to St. James's and we rode the same train. So I went back there very frequently. I enjoyed being there, just being with the sisters. And Sister Mary Irene was there, dead Sister Theodora, and Robertine. Jean Marie was postulant. She rode the train, the same train with us. And who else was there? There weren't too many of them. Theodora, Mary Irene. I don't recall any others, you know, this time. There couldn't have been too many because, see, I was in the school in 2 years, and it was a small school. We had 11 in my eighth grade, so there couldn't have been too many.
You mentioned Sister Louise.
she was handicapped. She had a vision problem. And I thought she was the smartest person that ever was. Because she knew everything. She never had a referral book. She was certainly well prepared. We didn't know that she was had a handicap. I just thought she was too smart.
You didn't know that she had a handicap.
She used to bring the book up like this, not in front of us.